Welcome back to the Squawker Talk Up podcast. I'm your host, Greg Johnson, and joining me today is James Dale. How are you doing, James?
I'm very well, thanks, Greg. How are you?
I'm not bad. You haven't been on for a while, have you?
It's been a few weeks, you know.
It's good to have you back,
break.
Anyway.
Thank you very much.
A bit more of a regular, it's Greg Lee.
Yeah, I'd love a rest.
Need an international break or something for you, don't
yeah,
we?
Yeah, only joking.
It's good to have you on as well, even good if you be, might yeah. be a grudging...
No, not at all, maker. Not at all.
No, but we start the show with Newcastle United, who have secured promotion to the Premier League, beating Preston North End in the Championship. It's expected of them to come back up, but is there any disappointment that they didn't win the title ahead of Brighton, given their resources, given the fact they've got Rafa Benitez as manager, James?
Well, I mean, Rafa said before the game, in a week's time, no one's going to care who won the league, which is, in fairness, true. Mm. I think to Brighton, it will have meant a lot more to win the league based on their kind of silverware record, though Newcastle's isn't great either. Mm. Sorry, Newcastle fans. But I think, it's more the fact that they've kind of limped the line as opposed to, charge full steam ahead. Mm. When Chris Hughton was in charge of Newcastle, they absolutely flew to the title. So, I think it's a clear sign that they will need to improve for next season, definitely.
Mm. And where do you see them coming up to kind of contest which part of the Premier League table? Because there's been a lot of talk that a year in the Championship, get the house in order, they come back as a more solid unit, could be mid-table or higher. Well, what do you make of Newcastle's chances next season, Greg?
I think a lot will depend on the investment in the squad. If they obviously have the resources, kind of in terms of the size of the club, to be a mid-table team. Next season, I think it will all be about kind of consolidating, finishing as high as you can, but without kind of really looking for a top 10 finish or anything like that. But that will definitely be the medium-term goal.
Mm. And in terms of Chris Hughton, obviously he's got experience in the Premier League, both in Newcastle and Norwich. But there's a bit of uncertainty over what kind of style of play he brings to a team. He's more of not a pragmatist in the negative sense, but he's more of a man manager, isn't he? How would you rate his abilities as a manager and what you're expecting from him next season, James?
Well, I mean, he's actually got a good record everywhere he's been. He was kind of unfairly treated at both Newcastle and Norwich, really. Mm. At Birmingham, he did a fantastic job. So, I mean, I think it'll be interesting to see how he approaches it, whether he kind of, he develops a clear style and Brighton become a particular team. Often the promoted teams come up and they're a certain style of play, like a Bournemouth or something.
A breath of fresh air.
Exactly, as we like. But no, I think it'll be... I'm quite intrigued to just see how he does approach it.
Mm. So. I mean, Brighton, it seems like they're a team with such a positive momentum. I know they've tried to get into the Premier League for a few years, but they finally do it now. They've got this wonderful stadium just outside of Brighton. Maybe there's a sense that he was fighting fires at other clubs, and this could actually be a bit of a clean break opportunity for Chris Hughton as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, Brighton are kind of fast becoming everyone's sort of second club. It's a very trendy place to be right now, on the beachfront. And I think everyone kind of wants them to do well. Mm. So let's see what he does.
Mm, absolutely. Well, moving now to the FA Cup. There's obviously a lot of Premier League interest in the FA Cup. Greg, you were at Wembley for both games this weekend. Chelsea obviously beat Spurs. Pretty excellent spectacle, really. Was it kind of worthy of a final in all but its name?
Yeah, probably. I think these are the two best teams in the semi-finals and in the Premier League. It could have been the final, definitely. I think we kind of saw that in the game as well, that comparing the two semi-finals, the first one was more enjoyable. You could see why these two teams are slightly ahead of Arsenal and Man City at this stage. Really excellent game and could have gone either way, really. I think 2-goal margin kind of flatters Chelsea in a way. It was a lot tighter than that. But yeah, Chelsea ultimately all season long, they've kind of got the job done where they've needed to. And we saw that again here.
Conte surprised a lot of people before the game with his team selection. Hazard, Costa and Fabregas all started on the bench. Bit of a tactical masterstroke worthy of a heroic semi-final. It's going to kind of add to the narrative, doesn't it, James?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's worked out perfectly for him, obviously, now. I mean, had, it gone to extra time and, it got a lot more nervy, I think people would have questioned why they weren't on earlier or from the start. But, with Hazard coming on and obviously scoring, it's just perfect in the end for him, and it makes him look, like a genius, especially considering Chelsea playing, tonight, then you've got tomorrow playing, Tottenham playing tomorrow. If they go and win tonight with a full strength team, it puts the pressure straight back on Tottenham.
Yeah.
So it has turned out exactly perfectly, which is pretty much how it's gone for Conte all season.
Mm.
So,
Well, Ake has actually played in the Premier League for Chelsea this season since returning from Bournemouth. He's only played in the FA Cup games. Did him and Batshuayi show enough to suggest they should get more opportunities in the first team with the season winding down for you, Greg?
Yeah, I think so. I think this season still, as long as the gap is still 4 points, I think Conte will be reluctant to not field Costa up front. And if they were kind of running away with it more than they are, then I think maybe we would see a bit more experimentation. But even then, I think Conte's so relentless that he would just name what he thinks is his strongest 11. But Nathan Ake, I think, probably is in that at the moment. If there are injuries, I thought he was really good. He was really good at centre-back for Bournemouth earlier this season, but this is obviously a totally different level to come in to a semi-final at Wembley against one of your biggest rivals. Really accomplished performance. And yeah, he's a player who, when people have spoken about young players at Chelsea in recent years, he's kind of gone under the radar a little bit. But I think he's right up there in terms of a youngster who has a good chance of establishing himself in the first team.
Mm. I think he actually made his debut all those 3 years back, I think it was. Played in a defensive midfield position, I think. So it's interesting how he's moved around the team. He's played at wing-back as well. Maybe gives him more opportunities to play in the first team going forward, because Chelsea do have quite a few kind of positions at the back he can slot into. Spurs, Wembley curse, do you buy into it? Or was this just a case of two very good sides with the margins just going Chelsea's way, James?
I think it's less about the Wembley curse and more about the big occasion. I mean, Spurs are consistently proving themselves in the league to be such a good, formidable side. Mm. But then when it comes to these sort of one-off nights, one-off days, you know, in a big game, they still can't quite seem to, like, bridge that gap to become a top club.
Yeah.
So I think it's, yeah, I don't know if I'm buying into the Wembley curse. I think it's more, can these players, you know, do it on the big occasion? Mm. And, you know, we're kind of yet to see it, so.
Mm. I mean, there is an argument that, we don't want to go into the whole Spursy cliche, of course, but they're such a good side defensively, but they seem to save all their mishaps for the games against the big teams. Lloris, I mean, he's got more clean sheets in the Premier League than anybody else this season, but he saved these kind of flappy moments for Liverpool and Manchester City, the kind of games you don't want to make those mistakes. Now, De Vera obviously gave away the free kick for Willian to score. A wonderful free kick. I mean, obviously, you know, he can't be blamed too much for the quality of the set piece, but how do they iron these wrinkles out of their game, Greg?
I probably think they're a lot closer than some maybe reports have suggested. I think this game, as I said, could really have gone either way. Chelsea seemed to score all their chances and all their half chances as well, like Matic's goal.
Kind of in the story of their season as
well. Yeah, there's not much you can do about that. I think Tottenham did play well. They kind of struggled once they got up to Chelsea's penalty box. I thought they struggled to really carve out loads of clear opportunities. But in terms of the middle of the pitch, the second half, they did control it. And a semi-final at Wembley, it lends itself to kind of big conclusions and big narratives, but I just think this was a case of a tight game swung one way, and it doesn't mean that Tottenham are any less on an upward curve than we thought they were before it.
Mm. Well, in the final, Chelsea will take on another London rival in Arsenal, and Greg there spoke about how Spurs struggled once it got to the final third a little bit. City had a kind of similar problem against Arsenal, and they were probably even more dominant against the Gunners than Spurs were against Chelsea, who also dominated the possession much of the game. Wenger went with a back three again. Some fans weren't entirely convinced because they weren't seeing all of the ball, but it seemed to me like Arsenal enjoyed the task of defending with that extra man at the back.
Well, Wenger's this new dynamic, innovative manager, isn't he? So Wenger in. But no, I mean, the three at the back, I think, in a way, Arsenal are probably one of the teams that can most suit. I mean, one of the interesting things with Chelsea is how David Luiz has kind of been masked in his defensive incapabilities by playing in that three centre-back partnership. And I think with Arsenal, with all their kind of centre-backs being slightly, you know, dodgy in a two-man partnership, you know, when there's three there, it kind of gives them that extra sort of comfort. And then you've got Oxlade-Chamberlain, who looks absolutely ready-made to play in that right wing-back role.
Yeah.
I mean, it's probably the best couple of games I've seen him play in years, really, in that role. So I think, you know, with Monreal on the other side, why not keep it going if it's working? So
what did you make of Oxlade-Chamberlain's performance? Obviously, him and Leroy Sané's battle as the kind of two attacking wing-backs down each of their sides respective flanks.
Yeah, I thought Oxlade-Chamberlain was really good. Even in the first half, when Arsenal were under the cosh for most of it, he was the guy kind of driving them forward on the counter-attack, won a few kind of corners, set pieces, little things like that, which were really important, I thought, for Arsenal to just break up the play.
And put in the cross for the equaliser.
Then obviously the second half, I think he was even better. So yeah, a great performance. And he's a player who never been sure where his best position is, and the debate has normally been out wide, kind of further forward, or in central midfield. But this wing-back role really has opened up another kind of alternative, and at the moment it looks to be the best one for him.
Mm. I mean, there's been a little bit of talk, mischievous talk, you might say, of Pep Guardiola and Antonio Conte being interested in his services. Do you think this might even force their hand further, showing, hey, look, guys, I can play in a back three formation running down the right wing? I mean, that could probably suit City and Chelsea.
Yeah, I think so. And Conte is the one, I think, whose interest would probably be stronger if there was. I just think he would cost a lot, wouldn't he, if he's an English player, to sell to a rival. Arsenal might be losing two of their biggest players this summer anyway. So,
And Wenger has said that would be huge damage to the side if they lost Oxlade. Chamberlain, but do you think his future is at wing back, or does he need to play in this central midfield role that he almost looked like he was going to make that his own earlier this season?
Yeah, I mean, we have sort of seen it where we often get excited about a new position for him and we think, oh, this is his
chosen. He's got so many, hasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, some players are just, you know, more versatile. It reminds me a little bit in the way of Milner, in that he's kind of a victim of his own sort of ability to play so many positions. And I think I do think, though, with his pace, I mean, he's so quick. Mm. And it feels like in central midfield, sometimes that's kind of wasted. But his combative side as well kind of, you know, also creates a case for that. So, I mean, I think he would certainly be a player that would attract Conte and Pep's interest. I mean, if you look at Victor Moses' role in Chelsea's side, I think Oxlade-Chamberlain could very much do that role as well. Mm. So it'll be interesting to see whether Arsenal kind of how much they kind of want to hold on to him, really.
Mm. And it was interesting, actually, speaking of wing-backs, it was also wing-backs that kind of decided the first semi-final between Spurs and Chelsea, because Son Heung-min moved to left wing-back by Poch, and quite another bold tactical move this weekend. Mm. He fouled Victor Moses, the right wing-back for Chelsea, to give away the penalty. So, I mean, is this something we're going to see more of now that teams are going to back-free systems and all the rest? A wing-back to me become more of a focal point for the tactical battles to decide the big games, Greg?
Yeah, if the formation does remain kind of prominent next season, it definitely has this season. I wonder, Conte, you can't see him changing the three at the back system, and because they've had so much success this year, I think a lot of managers have just looked at that and tried to replicate it. If Chelsea maybe struggle a bit more next season, and maybe if City are at the top playing a different formation, I wonder whether there'll be a shift away from that again. But at the moment, it's definitely the position which is kind of, yeah, is most intriguing in a way, because you've got those direct battles in a key area of the pitch.
Mm-hmm. And everyone's talked about the way that fullbacks are kind of the free role for quite a while in a tactical sense. I think Jack Charlton was the guy who first said that, wasn't he? An unexpected source of tactical intrigue there. But another way that Arsenal won the game against City, some might say, was they got a little bit nasty. After 23 minutes, David Silva was forced off the park. Limping off the park, you might say. Lots of fouls going his way. Pep was absolutely apoplectic on the sideline, throwing his hands in the air, kind of ushering away, as in, like, you know, come away. Don't let those horrible, mean Arsenal boys hurt you. Put it into the bench. Have they needed this mean streak, or is it, again, a bit like the Spurs Wembley curse? It's a bit of a cliche. We'd a lot of talk about, oh, George Graham would have sorted this team out, but is this what we saw at Wembley, James?
I think it's more just at that point where, I mean, Wenger had to win this game. He absolutely had to. And I think, you know, the players kind of almost embodied his mentality, really, and just that it was a case of any means cost, really. So, I mean, I don't know. I think Arsenal are kind of, they get away with looking like a very sort of easy on the eye team, but they've often had a mean streak within them. It's not like this
is
anything.
Well, people miss it from the Vieira period.
Exactly. This isn't anything massively new, I don't think. Mm. So, I mean, you know, I think it will have been a wake-up call to City, in that, obviously, you know, Silva was kind of holed off, and I think they were a bit taken aback by it. But, I mean, for Arsenal, I don't think it's anything massively new.
Is it what they've been missing, though? I mean, where did this come from? If they would have played with this kind of aggressiveness, intensity for the rest of the season, they might be closer to their overall objectives, though, rather than just an FA Cup final.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's probably a small part of the bigger problems that Arsenal have had this season and in recent years, really. Still think in these big games they obviously came out on top in this one, but I think the lack of kind of plan, sometimes a clear tactical kind of way to go about the game in these big games, to try and adapt your own style, which we did see this weekend, so you've got to give Wenger credit there. But I think that's been a bigger problem in these big games rather than any kind of big lack of aggression, because if you look at some of the other teams at the top now, you could probably level the same thing at them if they weren't playing well. City, maybe, for example, do they have the same thing? The same problem that Arsenal accused of, you could probably say so at times. So, yeah, I think it was probably one thing that maybe overplayed a little bit, but yeah, definitely.
In terms of City's own problems, as I say, Silva was forced off the pitch. mean that their kind of three-eight system that they like to play with, those two free roaming playmakers, couldn't quite work as well without him, because he seems to be the guy who gives the balance next to De Bruyne, isn't he? Doesn't quite work to the same extent without them both on the field. But still, Kompany was the main guy at the back for them. Aguero, the main guy at the front, scored that wonderful goal. Yaya Toure stepped in to be the holding man, and Fernandinho was on the pitch as well. Pep's side, it's still got the spine of the sides that won those first two titles under Mancini and Pellegrini. Are you surprised that there hasn't been more of a renovation of this side this season, given all the hype around Guardiola coming in, what he did at Barcelona, what he did at Bayern Munich, Greg?
Yeah, possibly, but they did spend a lot of money last summer. They did bring in a lot of players. Maybe Guardiola thought he'd be able to make more progress with the players that were already there than he has. I'm sure there'll be more big recruitment this summer from him, because he's obviously realised that for whatever reason, whether it's him failing to adapt or the players just not being good enough for that system, then I think he's come to the conclusion now that big changes will be needed again in the summer. But I don't think he could have done too much more last summer, just because you can't really bring in 15 new players in.
This will be the first time he hasn't won a trophy in his first season at a new club. But City's goals are long-term, aren't they? Not short-term, James. This isn't going to be a problem for him.
Yeah, I mean, I think when they brought Pep in, they're obviously looking long-term. I mean, City's been quite a further ahead-looking club for quite a while now, obviously with the academy system and everything like that. I mean, interestingly, you've got Xavi talking about Pep signing Dele Alli this summer, which...
Xavi, you did say Pep was going to win a quadruple in his first season.
Exactly. I mean, I think Dele Alli is exactly the type of player that Pep will look to. I think he's kind of realised he is targeting English players, and I think he wants that kind of bite in there for the Premier League. Whether Dele Alli would have any interest in going to City is an interesting one. I mean, he's, you know, got a great thing going at Tottenham. But I do think that there will be fresh signings and he'll look a lot younger this time. I mean, with Aguero, I think a lot of the reason he has continued to play, even though he's been good, is because Gabriel obviously got injured.
And I guess you can say the same with Yaya Toure and Ilkay Gundogan as
exactly.
well.
Exactly. So, I mean, I think it's more that he's kind of begrudgingly kept with the same players than necessarily wanting to. But I think there'll be big overhauls in the summer.
Do you think they're close enough to, with the right summer, become a title contender next year?
I think the problem is that the other teams have just gotten so much stronger. I mean, for me, Pep's kind of issues are defensively and in goal. And I think his stubbornness is kind of, you know, making him stick with this, you know, Bravo in goal, trying to play from the back. And it's maybe it will work with time, but, you know, it's how much time has he got? So
I think the one positive thing for City fans going into the summer is there have been moments and they've maybe been more fleeting than you would want, but there have been some games where City have kind of reached almost another level in terms of the performance. We saw a home to Barcelona in the Champions League where they were brilliant, even at home to Tottenham in the Premier League where they actually drew, so maybe just lost a bit, but they were so dominant against a team who just aren't pulled apart in the manner that they were. So if they can replicate that a lot more often, it will have to be, obviously. But there are signs of positivity that they can take from the season, even though it will end ultimately in disappointment with no trophies.
Is that a mentality rather than a personnel or tactical thing then? Because we even saw it under Mancini and Pellegrini to some extent in the seasons after they won the title to try and defend it. It looked like a side that could rise themselves to the big occasions, but they didn't have the kind of the consistency, the focus to do it week in, week out. They seem like almost like adrenaline junkies to some extent. Is that still a problem with this team, you think, under Pep?
Yeah, well, the personnel, that core of personnel still is the same, so I'm not sure why that would suddenly have changed. And yeah, it's a strange, it's hard to put your finger on it sometimes with City in the last few years, but they've always felt like they're kind of doing the bare minimum at times and not really kind of pushing themselves. And under a manager like Guardiola, obviously, who's famed for his intensity and his relentlessness, that's probably not a good combination, so I'm sure he'll look to sort that out in the summer.
But then it's what you expect to change, isn't it, really, with his record elsewhere. We're going to come on to the Manchester Derby, which is happening this week in midweek, a little later on. But just before we do, we've been quite generous there, saying Pep's got this long-term objective he's chasing. Let's not judge him on the short-term. Why is it we don't offer Jose Mourinho the same kind of the same benefit of the doubt, James?
Well, that's because, I mean, United are used to winning the league every year. And, you know, Jose Mourinho also is used to winning the league every year. So when you put the two together, why aren't they winning the league every year? So, no, I think with United, it's kind of more of a case of, yeah, just that past history. And City fans, we forget, you know, they're used to seeing, like, Division 1 football. So, well, a fair amount of them are. So, I mean, you know, I think it is that expectation level is completely different still. I think that will, you know, take a while to change.
Do you think if Mourinho showed his work in more, he'd get the benefit of that as well? We saw with Van Gaal after his first season, always talking philosophy. People seem to kind of go, we'll judge him a little bit later on when the project, as people like to call football teams these days, has moved on a bit more. Do you think that if Mourinho showed more of an inkling of a system, he might get more patience as well?
Yeah, maybe. I wonder with Mourinho, last season at Chelsea, it just went so spectacularly wrong, and Guardiola hasn't really had that moment yet. He's didn't win the Champions League at Bayern, but you can't call it a total failure or anything.
I don't know. That Leicester game was pretty bad.
Yeah. But I just wonder if people in the back of their minds are doubting slightly whether Mourinho has kind of lost that touch, whether last year was a sign of things to come, and maybe that informs the opinion now. But yeah, I agree with your general point that you need to judge managers on the same grounds, and it's only fair to apply the same kind of arguments to one as the other.
Well, we're going to come back to that a little bit more later on, because obviously that is the big match in midweek. There's many other big matches, but I'd probably say that's probably the biggest. Just going to say, going to put it out there. But there was a huge match in Spain at the weekend. For non-English interest, it's probably the biggest match in the world. El Clasico, Real Madrid 2, Barcelona 3. Vintage Lionel Messi, you could say. He's had a few doubters, even though he's had a great individual season this year, but he absolutely changed the game. We didn't just change the game, he won it with an amazing goal at the death. What is he doing differently this season, and kind of what is he doing the same? Is it the same old Messi? We're just viewing him under different perceptions?
I think there are elements of the same. He's still got the dribbling ability, that acceleration to get away from players is as amazing as ever. But he's playing more withdrawn now, the system. It was almost like a 4-4-2 at times, 4-4-2 diamond sometimes on Sunday, with Paco Alcacer and Suarez higher up the pitch, and Messi kind of assumes this role, more number 10 role, more central. And he just seems somehow, it seemed impossible, but he somehow seems even an even more complete player now, because he's kind of taking on the controlling of games as well with his passing. Obviously Barcelona, when they lost Xavi, have trying to been find someone who can do that, take over that role. But he's managed to combine that with still the devastating touch in the final third and the dribbling, as I say, the creation of chances, the goals. So yeah, I think somehow he seems to have almost gone to another level, which is pretty crazy.
We said in the podcast last week that just purely how these things are judged, Ronaldo is probably going to be ahead of him in the race to win the Ballon d'Or, because he threw into the Champions League last four now. Real Madrid are still, probably even after this defeat, are probably still favourites for the title in Spain. It's Messi, though. I know Messi versus Ronaldo is a whole podcast in its own way, but is Messi kind of, should he be the Ballon d'Or winner every year, if you're that kind of way inclined, who's the better player overall?
I mean, in my opinion, yeah, Messi wins it every year. I mean, I've just never seen a player with his ability in my time. I'm not sure many people have ever. I think with the El Clasico game, it was just so interesting the way it just produced such an iconic moment. It's one of those moments where you know, with Messi holding his shirt up in front of the crowd. It was just him. It was almost him proving himself to himself and to all the fans around, I am the best, and you'll remember this. And, you know, you could see Ronaldo head down in the background, shaking his head. And it was just a kind of like, it was as if they both realised in that moment, okay, yeah, Messi is the better player. And, you know, Ronaldo will be ahead in terms of, you know, Real Madrid's achievements and his own achievements still. But when Messi does things like that, it's just, there's no other player that can do that.
Just a level above, isn't he?
Exactly. Yeah. And as Greg said, I think he has stepped up a new level. I think he's kind of popping up in positions that no one's kind of seen him in before. He's dictating the game from further back and then somehow ending up to finish the chance off as well. So it's ridiculous.
He's almost reinventing himself in a similar way to how Ronaldo has a couple of times now, as Ronaldo's lost that a bit of the power he had. He's stripped his game down to become more of a finisher. But as you say, Messi's no longer the false nine. He's like the playmaker, isn't he?
Yeah, he's the controller. He's almost doing like three roles in one, really, which is not bad if you can get a player to do that.
Not bad at all. One player that certainly stuck to his role in the script was Sergio Ramos, always the man for a bit of drama and theatricality. He was sent off in the game ahead of Barcelona's winner. Is it moments like these that make people kind of hesitant to call him a great defender in his own right?
I think so. I mean, you know, he has always got that streak in him. And, you know, you saw him walking off and mouthing at Piqué and Piqué giving it back. The difference is Piqué has kind of held it together when he's needed to.
Yeah.
And, I mean, what Ramos was thinking, diving in like that from about 20 yards away on the best player in the world. You know, it was,
I think,
just,
you know what he was thinking.
Well, exactly. But I mean, yeah, it's just ludicrous. Yeah. Like, I mean, you know, even if he takes the ball, he gets sent off for the 2-foot challenge. So I don't know what he was thinking.
Mm-hmm. But is this kind of part of the genius of Sergio Ramos? Many people have talked in the past about, you take the drive and the anger out of Wayne Rooney's game, he's less of a player. Is this the amount of times Ramos has stood up big in the big occasion for Real Madrid and for Spain? It's just kind of part of what drives him on.
Maybe it's like a trade-off, isn't it?
Yeah. Because
you can't kind of have both. But yeah, I still think in the big moments, he has delivered goals, big goals in the Champions League finals and that. But yeah, as a defender as well, the comparison with Rooney, not necessarily in terms of getting sent off, but in terms of making silly mistakes like that, rushes of blood to the head, I think they can be more decisive if you're the centre-back than Rooney.
It could be decisive. Barcelona take on Osasuna in midweek. Deportivo take on Real Madrid. Zidane's side can't let this slip, even after that El Clasico loss, can they, James?
Well, I mean, the Spanish press were pretty brutal in their criticism afterwards.
Rumours he's going to get sacked if he doesn't win.
I mean, to me, that's insane considering the start he's had to his Real Madrid career as manager. And but I guess that is the expectation level. And if he does end up this season trophyless, having been in the positions they are, they will be calling for his head. And it seems ridiculous to say, but, you know, Real Madrid needs to be winning trophies, and they have done for the last few years. I don't think they will let it slip. I think they will still win the league purely because of that extra game in hand. But I do think there'll be questions asked of Zidane at the end of the season, but he could yet end up with the Champions League as well. So in about 2 weeks' time, we might be saying, what a brilliant man.
We may well be. I mean, he's got such a brilliant squad. That's kind of the thing, isn't it, Greg?
Yeah, and in recent games in La Liga, it's worked for him. They've come out on top, but he's really rotated his side quite heavily ahead of kind of Champions League matches. I'm sure if they'd have won this or drawn this, he probably would have kept doing the same. But now he's probably facing a situation where he has to play essentially his strongest team for both of the semi-final legs and also all the La Liga games, because if he was to let it slip from here, his head ultimately would be the one that he would be blamed for that. So it's a tough predicament for Madrid in terms of how they balance the two now.
I think will be really interesting is whether Asensio kind of continues his place inside.
Yeah.
He has been absolutely brilliant when he's played.
I was going to say, the BBC is almost over, isn't
exactly.
It? It's not working anymore.
And, you know, I think for Zidane, that's a big call to make. You know, does he stand firm and say, no, we're sticking with the BBC? Or does he, you know, say, actually, Asensio has earned his place inside, stick him in there? And, you know, arguably, Asensio should be looking at, if they do make the Champions League final, he should be looking at starting place, whether Bale's in there or not. So, you know, that'll be an interesting call.
Isco, another player who's kind of delivering in a way to push against the headline acts at Madrid. So it'll be fascinating, not only to see how the title race goes, but what kind of shape Real Madrid end up in at the end of the season. Moving now to the Premier League, the results in the weekend's fixtures. Liverpool lost 2-1 at home to Crystal Palace. What is it about Palace and Liverpool, Greg?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing at Anfield as well, particularly three wins in a row now.
It's usually down in South London that they come a cropper, isn't it?
Yeah, although I think Palace's record is actually better at Anfield. Liverpool definitely won earlier this season, 4-2 at Selhurst Park. They won last season. Ben Tedry scored a late penalty against Palace on that occasion. Obviously, the Cristanbul, as it's been christened, it sticks in people's minds. But yeah, Palace's record at Anfield is much better. And it's hard to say what it is, really, because you just don't expect a smaller team to be this kind of dominant in one of those big stadiums against a big team.
And managers have changed, personnel have changed.
I think maybe Palace have played them at a good moment in each time, just looking back to some previous seasons. I remember under Pardew when they were under a similar run as they are now with Allardyce. It was, again, they were kind of really in their stride at that moment. If they'd have played them earlier in the season, I'm sure they would have got blown away. But I guess it poses bigger questions of Liverpool as well, because this is a theme not just with Palace this season, but in these games at home, where they haven't lost that many, actually. They lost to Swansea, but they've dropped points in a fair few of them or had unconvincing wins. So I guess in that sense, it's more of a continuation of a theme we've seen all season for Liverpool.
Another continuation of a theme is Christian Benteke doing the business for a struggling Premier League side in the final weeks of the season. Does he just save his best till last, or is he a man for the Does he just, is it a bit like we're talking about Man City? Does he get this adrenaline rush like I'm needed now to save my team from relegation? Well, what is it about Benteke at Villa and now at Palace? He just livens him up in these moments.
Well, I think as these teams get towards the end of the season and they start getting more sort of direct, more dangerous, it obviously suits his style of play. I mean, it's very much a kind of, we've got to win it. We need to get the ball in the box. I actually really rate Benteke. I think he's a good, solid player. I think he's obviously phenomenal in the air, but I think he's got a good touch as well, and he brings players into the game. I think Palace are now playing a way that suits him. I think had they played that way earlier in the season, you might have seen more goals from him. But I mean, I think it was interesting to see you got Lovren and Origi and then Benteke and Sacco at Palace. I would argue that Benteke and Sacco, you know, would be players that Liverpool fans would rather have in the side. So I mean, I think there's questions to be asked about Klopp there and what he's chosen to do, especially when, you know, after a 2-1 defeat to Palace. So
yeah, he wasn't a happy man after the game. Is there any danger of Liverpool slipping out of the top four at this rate?
Yeah, definitely. The games in hand that City and United have, I know one of them is against each other, so they both can't win, but Liverpool have got to really look to be winning all their remaining games now because they just don't have as many of them, so they need to get as many points as they can. And if they were to have another slip-up, it's strange because a few weeks ago you looked at the run-ins, the respective run-ins of the teams, and normally you would look at Liverpool's and say, wow, that's perfect for them. But
it's funny what confidence does to you, doesn't it?
But they'd probably rather have a couple of big games in there just because their record in those matches is so good. But the fact they're playing teams like Palace, like West Brom, like Bournemouth, who they've played in recent weeks, it's proved a headache for them all season. And yeah, I think their top four spot is in big danger now.
What can they do to keep a grip on it? Obviously, Mane being out is a hammer blow. Their chances there. They look twice as dangerous when he's in there and obviously half as dangerous when he's not. What can Klopp do to change this?
Well, I think Klopp's, you know, he's been stubborn and he's been reluctant to change. And I think, you know, we've seen it that they've struggled against the sort of lower teams who play this more direct style, like West Brom's, the Palaces. And I think, you know, I mean, Sam Allardyce pointed out after the game, he said, you know, we knew exactly what to do. Liverpool were playing zonal marking. We knew where we'd catch them and on the counter-attacks. And Klopp didn't, he must have known that as well and didn't try and sort it out before the game. So I think he's got to look at himself and say, all right, am I going to switch it up for these types of teams? Perhaps against the bigger teams, it doesn't matter if you do zonal marking because they play in a different style and they're not, you know, a threat in the air in perhaps the same way.
You're both trying to put your game plan forward,
exactly.
Aren't you?
Yeah. But I mean, I think it's almost a bit arrogant to not change his style of play for certain teams. I think, you know, you've got West Brom and Crystal Palace. They're just as much a threat as anyone else in the Premier League. So,
isn't that part of Klopp's charm, though? That he has his way of playing. You're going to stick to it. And a bit like Guardiola, he might argue, I'm not going to try and read the man's mind, but I'm guessing where his thinking may be, that my game, my plan A is so good, if I stick to it in the long term, it will produce a team that can win titles and all the rest of it.
Well, it might be charming, but it's not working just yet. So I think if you ask Liverpool and Man City fans, they'd want to win. So, I mean, you know, maybe it will work in 2 or 3 seasons' time, but
will he have the time if
exactly.
he doesn't win things? Yeah.
Premier League managers don't last long, so good luck.
speaking of good luck, will Spurs need it on Wednesday night when they take on Palace? Big Sam and Big Benteke be the kingmakers in the Premier League title race this season, Greg?
Yeah, well, they've already done their best to disrupt the big teams as kind of hopes of qualifying for the Champions League or winning the title wins against Chelsea, Arsenal, Liverpool already. So Tottenham, definitely, I think this is really key for Tottenham because last season against Chelsea, they had that disappointment in a 2-2 draw and from then they kind of collapsed. And I think even if they don't win the title this year, it's not even about the title in a way. It's more they just need to prove to themselves they can bounce back, get straight back into it because the top four is done for Tottenham, isn't it, really? But you don't want to end the season on a negative and you want second.
And I do think second is almost like a dress rehearsal. As you say, if they can prove that they can deal with the pressure of not being the team to lead it, but they are definitely leading the rest of the pack, they can hold that pressure off. Yeah. That'll answer so many questions, won't it?
Yeah, definitely. But I think this game against Palace will be tough because you just know what Allardyce will do. Palace will defend deep, men behind the ball, counter-attacks. And Liverpool, I think their best kind of chances, strangely, came themselves on the counter-attack when Palace, at times, kind of pushed a few bodies forward and then the transition from that. So I think Spurs need to take full advantage of any moments like that. And Palace, because they're at home, they'll probably feel a bit more kind of emboldened to go on and do that a bit more often. So I think Spurs can can look for those moments, and they could be decisive for both teams, kind of that, those counter-attacking transition moments.
Mm. There was a lot of bad press about Palace's whole squad, actually, early in the season. Scott Dan was like the only guy getting any semblance of like respect from the fans, even on match day. Obviously, Damien Delaney was confronted by a fan at the stadium. But it's not just been Benteke and Sakho that have kind of pulled them out of the mire, is it? There's been a few more players that have stood up for Palace in recent weeks.
Yeah, well, I mean, Wilfried Zaha and Andros Townsend have both been absolutely brilliant. I mean, Zaha he's going to be one of the most sought-after players in the transfer window, I should think. I mean, he could have gone last window. And I think Tottenham will be a bit aggrudged now they didn't sort of up the money and really try and go for him.
Imagine if you would have spent that Sissoko money on Zaha.
Exactly. I mean, arguably now Zaha will warrant that kind of fee. Yeah, I mean, Palace all over have been much better. I mean, in fairness, Allardyce brought in Milivojevic. Exactly.
Milivojevic.
I've practiced.
There we go. Palace fan through and through. Now, he's been excellent holding that sort of midfield anchor role, because before they were playing sort of Kabay there, they tried punching there, and they're just not that kind of anchor point. And he's made a world of difference and allowed the ball to sort of move out quickly then to the wings and freed up Kabay and Punchin, who have been far improved since, really.
I mean, look at the stats. That's what's quite interesting. When Sakho came in, he immediately went top of the rankings for passes per game. And then
Milivojevic.
I didn't remember it. I wanted to get you here one more time. Yeah. Hear the music.
I'm always here for...
Absolutely. He's now top of the rankings for passes per game. So it's almost like Big Sam's turn to the ball players to get them out of trouble.
Yeah, I think that's often underestimated with Sakho particularly. I think because he just looks so dandy and awkward, people underestimate that he is actually a good footballer. And
he's not Jimmy Traore.
Yeah, exactly. He can play. But I think that has been one of the most important things, because previously, if a long ball came towards a Palace centre-back, they were kind of just hoof it clear and then you'd give possession straight back, where Sakho kind of, even if a long ball's been played towards an opposition striker, he kind of brings it down on his chest, picks a pass, and that's been really important and something that has not just improved. He's not just improved the defensive side of Palace, also going forward as well.
And I often think people massively underestimate how hard it is to play direct football well as well. If you're doing long balls and you want to hit them like 50 yards pinpoint accuracy, that takes serious skill and bringing the ball down under that pressure. So, you know, maybe underrated a little bit, Palace, in their approach under Big Sam.
It's not all. There have been good moments as well. I think Zaha and Townsend do. You can play direct. It does not always long ball direct. It's often getting wide, getting your wingers one-on-one, and it is a quick counter-attack as well. But I think Allardyce deserves credit for the fact it's not just been kind of hitting hope or anything like that.
That's kind of what I mean. It never always has been with Big Sam. He kind of suffers under his own caricature, doesn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Just one last thing on their match in midweek against Spurs. Obviously, we saw Son line up at left wing back for Spurs at Wembley, with Kieran Trippier coming at right wing back. Maybe that was Pochettino resting players for this game as well. But we expect Kyle Walker to be back in the team, don't we?
Oh yeah, I think he will have thought about Palace, and I think he will have outlined that for that reason. I mean, you'll have Townsend probably on the right and Zaha on the left, and then they often just switch up. So I think, you know, if Rose does come back in time, with him and Walker there, that'll be one of the great battles. It'll be perfect to see how, you know, Zaha and Townsend do actually manage against those kind of players.
But there is a concern about Rose. Obviously, he missed his fitness test for Wembley. There's not 100% sure he's going to make it for Palace. Ben Davis didn't play at Wembley. He looked a little bit... I think he was ill, wasn't he? That's why they played Son there instead. When he came on in the second half, Walker actually played. Was he on the right or was he on the left?
Walker went on the right, Trippier moved over, yeah.
Could that be a solution if Davis and Rose aren't fit enough?
Yeah, it would probably have to be. And I guess, I remember earlier this season, I think it was against Chelsea actually, where Kevin Vimmer played in that left-sided role and it didn't really work at all. So I think Pochettino's clearly favouring someone who normally plays at wing-back on one of the sides, or at least out wide in Son's case, but... Obviously, the penalty was a huge moment for Son and it went wrong, but maybe in this game where he's going to be playing, whoever is wing-back will be playing very high up the pitch, maybe he'll be willing to take that risk again, knowing that Son can contribute on the other side of the ball as well.
And interestingly, when Liverpool played Palace and beat them early in the season, Moreno played at left-back and he was bombing on all games. So maybe that attacking threat from deep is what they will need. Moving on now to the rest of the Premier League action before we get to the midweek fixtures. Hull and Swansea kept up their own little two-team battle. It was not quite a title race, but it is a fight for survival, with both teams winning 2-0 against Watford and Stoke, respectively. Only one can survive, probably, unless something horrible happens to Burnley. James, who would you prefer it to be?
I don't really know, to be honest. I think both.
That's not an answer.
I know. I'm going to sit on the fence on this one. I think both teams have actually sort of really proven themselves to be a good passing side since the new managers have come in. They've kind of, you know, done their best to sort of adapt, and like, I like them both. I like the football they're
You'd
both
playing. You'd have both. Would you have Burnley?
I would rather actually.
Big shout, Greg. What about yourself?
If I had to choose between one of these, I'd go for Hull, I think, and basically purely because of Marco Silva. I think he's done an amazing job, which obviously has been spoken about a lot before, but just the squad he inherited and then changed quite a lot in January, and it was right towards the end of the window as well, where he brought in a lot of players. So to have that instant impact almost, and winning their home games all the time, getting a new style across, kind of tightening up one end while also being more kind of attacking in the other end as well, I think he's done brilliantly. So I'd like to see maybe him rewarded with by keeping them up.
Even if he doesn't, you'd imagine, having done what he's done, he's going to get another job, another good job somewhere. Probably not on Gillette Soccer Saturday, though, with Merce and Tomo.
I think, it will be really tight, though, because I was looking at the fixtures before we came in, and Hull basically win their home games but don't win their away games.
Yeah.
But one of their home games is against Tottenham, so if you're looking at that and maybe thinking maybe not 3 points in that one, they're going to need something in one of their away games because Swansea's running is probably the slightly more favourable. So
and the assay is going to be missing, though, isn't he?
The red card after his red card. Yeah,
yeah, I think they're appealing, but they don't often come through these appeals, do they? So
yeah. Interesting intrigue to come. And I mean, Paul Clement. I mean, Marco Silva's done a great job, but Clement, he didn't fail at Derby, but that became a blemish on his CV to some extent. Be nice if he had a bit of success in the Premier League, because he's clearly a talented coach. Moving on to the rest of the Premier League games, West Ham drew at home against Everton. Bit of a non-event in the end. Bournemouth, however, definitely turned on the goals. 4-0 against Middlesbrough. Woeful for Borough. They pretty much, they're dead and buried, aren't they, really? It's not going to happen for them. They're gone. Middlesbrough take on Sunderland on Wednesday. Can anyone think of a more uninspiring fixture? You've got a side that can't attack against a side that only defend.
I think it'd be a great game to watch. No,
connoisseur's choice.
I, as a sort of, you know, lower league fan myself, it's what I'm used to, and I kind of like that battle, weirdly. But no, I mean, for a neutral, my word. I mean, Middlesbrough, what a bad team.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just getting worse for them and worse. You got Ben Gibson, sort of, who apparently now is ready to leave already.
Yeah.
You know, he's clearly thinking about his next move. And it's a shame for them, because they looked sort of like they had a bit of promise when they first started. But
Karanka seemed to have like the perfect blueprint. Like, I'll spend the first half of the season creating like a foundation, and we can build on it. But they just didn't build on it. It just got more negative.
Yeah, I mean, I think just in front of goal, they're just so poor. I mean, I know they lost 4-0, but the defensive issues haven't been as bad. It's up front where, you know, Negredo hasn't really done it. Gested is just diabolical.
Well, when you need an alternative to Negredo and you go and sign just a worse version of him.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not very inspiring,
not
is it?
I think just on the uninspiring fixture thing, I remember, I think 2012, something like that, when QPR played Reading, and both teams were in a similar position to Middlesbrough and Sunderland now, and I think a win for either of them would have kind of kept the hope alive slightly, and they played out the most boring 0-0 draw, and both went down, so I think that would kind of be fitting for this one as well.
Yeah, maybe. Can you get like -1, -1 each? A weird kind of draw? Maybe we have to see something like that. Maybe 2 own goals. Maybe that's what will happen. Moving now to the other midweek fixtures. Manchester Derby on Thursday night. The big one, you could say. United won 2-0 over Burnley at the weekend. Goals from Martial and Rooney. Is Martial back? Is Mourinho's weird, aggressive, confrontational man management style actually paying dividends with the Frenchman? He slated him and he's come good again, hasn't he?
Yeah, well, I don't know why, but somehow this does seem to work. I don't think Martial's necessarily played massively badly. I think he perhaps just has been a bit unlucky in terms of finishing, and hasn't really had that run in the side to really get his momentum going. But you saw his goal. I mean, it was such a good goal, the way he sort of came up from the back and then, you know, finished it off. So I mean, weirdly, Mourinho has kind of spun this whole situation now where all his big guns are sort of coming into fire for the big occasion. Obviously Ibra's gone, but now Martial looks ready to maybe fill in the gap as well with Rashford. So,
and Rooney scored the kind of finish United have been missing all season, really.
It's just like perfect Mourinho, this, really. With Liverpool losing, it sets it up perfectly. If United go and win, they look odds on now to finish in the top four.
I mean, Rashford was rested for this game. Who do you expect to start up front against Manchester City, Greg?
I probably think Rashford still. That obviously was probably Mourinho's plan before the game because of the rest he gave him. maybe Martial's goal makes him reconsider that, but I still think Rashford will start up front. But United have just got so many options around kind of the striker as well that you can never predict too confidently who they'll play kind of in the support cast. So that again will be interesting to see who he goes for in that game. Mm-hmm. I think Mourinho's the type of manager who probably has an idea in his head, but even before the Burnley game, and kind of worked 2-3 games in advance. So I wonder if the Burnley performance will have changed anything, or whether he'll be kind of stick with what he thought he was going to go with anyway.
Mm. At the other end of the pitch, he's also got problems as well with injuries, having chipped away at his options. Kadeen Simmons asks, Fosu-Mensah and Tuanzebe, their lack of game time earlier this season, is that going to kind of bite Mourinho on the bum a little bit?
Well, that's a good point, really. I mean, you know, Mourinho's kind of been banking on this these experienced first-team players to see him through, and then right at the end now you've got Ibra going, you've got Rojo going, Mata injured. I mean, it is kind of that point where, well, if you'd have blooded these youngsters earlier, perhaps they'd be more ready for this kind of game. You're chucking in them now at a Manchester derby, and, you know, it's going to be a different kettle of fish. So it's a very good point. I mean, I actually think Fosu-Mensah probably has got enough experience that he would be able to cope with it, and I quite like him as a player. So, I mean, I don't think Rojo's the best centre-back in the world anyway, to be honest, so it may not be the biggest loss.
Good season, though, to be fair. So
he's had a good season, but if you actually look at him, the way he plays, when he's played against certain types of strikers, he's struggled. And I think, you know, against Aguero, he's the type of player that could have turned him inside out. So Fosu-Mensah might be almost a better option in terms of battling against him and being quicker. So
you won't be wearing a T-shirt then?
No.
No, fair enough. On the question of T-shirts and strikers being out for the season, we have had a question in from Pranav Shahani, who asks, do United need to now sign a world-class striker in the summer to replace Ibrahimovic, or should they stick with what they've got?
Yeah, Rashford is the one who would have the strongest case, I guess, to really lead the line, but I still think Mourinho, if he can, will try and bring someone in and kind of have those two as options. Mourinho's record with young players, I know it's been spoken about a lot, but Rashford now, you would count him as a first-team member rather than someone who you're throwing in there from nowhere, but I still think if the money is made available to him and there's a striker available, Griezmann's been linked a lot. I still think Mourinho would probably, given the competition in the Premier League now as well, would maybe err on the side of caution and try and bring in another option rather than... Rashford's been great ever since he broke through, but young players do have moments where they kind of dip out of form, injuries as well. So I still think he would look to bring someone in, yeah.
And you expect any changes from Pep Guardiola going into this game for City? Obviously, it's at the Etihad. He won at Old Trafford 2-1 in the first Manchester derby of the season in the league. Who holds the advantage? Do you see Guardiola trying any of his usual wonderful big game tactical gambits? And where do you think this game is going to be won or lost?
I think Pep is always capable of surprise, and he may well come up with a new formation. I mean, he seems to often do that for the big games. I think it'll be interesting if Gabriel Jesus is on the bench. I mean, he was sort of...
It was kind of
the big talk. Is he going to play, isn't he? And, I mean, Aguero came in. Aguero will play from the start, I'm convinced, anyway. But having Jesus on the bench might be an interesting option late in the game, throwing him on. I think City may adapt in the fact that they will have probably previously planned to obviously face Ibrahimovic. And now they're going to have, you know, Rashford, most likely, and possibly Martial. So it's going to be pace.
Pogba needs, you know.
Well, yeah. But also with City at the back, you've got Kompany and Otamendi. And if you're Rashford and Martial, I would be laughing at that. So I don't know whether he might look to bring in, you know, a quicker player at the back.
John Stones?
Perhaps.
What about yourself, Greg? Anything you see in this game as a potential flashpoint on the pitch?
I think it will be really interesting. I think United, despite the fact that maybe they come into this in the better form with the better momentum, I think Mourinho will go quite reactive.
Another
really
man-marking performance, maybe?
Yeah, possibly. Although, I don't know if Silva's going to be fit for this, and maybe he'd be the most obvious target of that. But I think United might win this. I think on the counter, as James says, if those are the two centre-backs, Kompany and Otamendi, who two of the worst centre-backs for kind of diving in unnecessarily high up the pitch, I think United might have a lot of joy in the counter-attack, and I can see City maybe having a lot of the ball, but United maybe hurting them on the other end.
Also, if you think Arsenal kick City about, wait till you see United. They will be lumping everything out of City on Thursday night. Sorry, United fans.
I think you might be right there, James. We'll have to see both for the visceral violence of it. And also hopefully some good quality football might break out in the midst of all that, but we'll have to see. Talking about the other midweek games, there's more intrigue from Wembley, not just Palace versus Tottenham Hotspur. Chelsea take on Southampton at the Bridge. Is that another banana skin, or do you think they should be okay against them?
I think they should be okay. Their record in these games is really, really good. They lost to Palace recently, of course, but generally they do the business against the teams outside the big six, the big seven. So yeah, I think this will be pretty straightforward for Chelsea, but it just goes to show again that both Conte and Pochettino tried to downplay the fact that the FA Cup might influence the title race as well. But if Chelsea had lost that game, having rested the players, they'd be under so much pressure tonight to do it, whereas it kind of feels more comfortable for them, more relaxed, and I think that will suit them. And yeah, I think this will be quite comfortable. Southampton never seem to play either, do they?
No.
Seems to have played about 10 games this season. So
yeah, they've had a strange season. Yeah. And obviously, without Gagliardini, they just seem to become a bit of a... And I don't mean it's in a disrespectful way, but a bit of a nothing team again. Like, they just haven't got him to kind of make the difference up front. They haven't really got anybody else at the moment. Arsenal take on Leicester City in midweek as well. Is this going to be a 3 out of 3 for the back three for Arsene Wenger, James?
Absolutely. I think, you know, why change it? I know Leicester are very much a kind of... what's the risk with them is obviously the fast counter-attacking football on the break.
Because they shredded City's back three.
Exactly. But, you know, I think Wenger, he's got to kind of keep this consistent momentum going. So I fully expect them to play three at the back again.
Obviously, Arsenal did the double over Leicester last year, the only side to do so. They only lost three games in the Premier League on their way to winning the title. Why is the Gunners' record so good against the Foxes? Is there anything in how they play versus how Leicester play?
I think if you take the games last season, say, I remember the game at the King Power, 5-2, I think it was, to Arsenal in the end. And I think that's the game where Ranieri kind of changed things a little bit. Swapped the fullbacks after that one because Arsenal on the counter-attack really did. I think Sanchez scored a hat-trick maybe in that game. And yeah, on the counter, Arsenal really kind of those quick combinations. But then I think the game at the Emirates was just changed by the sending off to Danny Simpson at the time. I think Leicester were actually either ahead or level. I think they were ahead at that point and they were playing really well. So I'm not sure in that game, for example, you can take anything into this one and say, here's the key to beat them. But
obviously we've got Shakespeare now. It's a whole new regime in the dugout.
It's kind of back to normality for Leicester. They're now just a mid-table team again, aren't they, after that adventure ended in the Champions League. So motivation-wise, I wonder whether they'll have quite the same appetite and hunger for that. But Vardy on the counter, that's the way they've hurt many teams in the last couple of years, and Arsenal could be vulnerable to that. But yeah, I think Arsenal would be too strong.
Fair enough. That's all your action in the Premier League. Looking back to the Championship, we obviously talked about Newcastle's rise up into the Premier League to join Brighton in the promotion playoffs, the automatic promotion playoffs. In the automatic promotion places, there's still the playoffs to come, which we'll come back to on another podcast soon. But Harry Redknapp's at Birmingham City, isn't he, James?
He is.
How's that going?
It's interesting, let's say that. I mean, he turned up having not really checked who Blues were even playing, I don't believe. Little did he know it was Villa at the weekend. He's still claiming that he's not being paid for the whole time he's going to be there until the end of the season. But I wouldn't be too surprised if there's a little bonus for keeping Blues in the Championship. My concerns are more the fact that I don't think he'll know who any of Birmingham's players are, really. I mean, most people don't. And I think Redknapp's been out of the game a little while. So it'll be interesting to see what he can do. He immediately switched to a 4 at the back after Zola's playing 3 at the back against Villa. And Blues did look a little bit tighter. But I tell you what, they are so poor in an attacking sense. I mean, you've got Jukowicz up front, who is their only sort of real outlet in any way. And they just pump balls up to them. And they're looking like they can't find a goal anywhere at the moment. I mean, Harry will probably only have to win one game to keep Blues up. They've got Huddersfield at home and Bristol City away. I don't know where that win's going to come from.
Yeah.
But if he does it, it'll be another Harry miracle. And then he's got a summer of wheeling and dealing. So, you know.
Do you think he'll stay on if he does it?
I think he'll stay on if Birmingham were kept up. But I think he's got a task on his hands.
I think it'd be really funny if Birmingham stay up despite not winning a game, because Blackburn obviously blow them, and then Redknapp gets his bonus anyway. Not bad for a few weeks' work.
But it's kind of better the devil you know, isn't it? Really, Zola was hired just on reputation, wasn't he? He's not a good enough manager for Birmingham.
Absolutely, and it just shows what, you know, owners making these snap decisions how much they can damage football league clubs. I mean, Zola, there was no real thinking behind Zola's appointment. I mean, he wasn't particularly successful at anywhere he's been so far. I mean, I know he did okay at Watford, but, you know, West Ham, he was poor. And with Rowett doing such a good job, I mean, Rowett went to Derby and got more points than Zola within about two games. So, I mean, Zola completely changed the team when it was a winning side. I mean, it was a not massively exciting side. They had very low possession, but hit teams on the counter-attack. Zola, in fairness, lifted the possession up to 70% of a in a game, but...
He's no Yap Stam, though, is he?
Can't score a goal. No, you know, he's no Yap Stam.
Is it a shame Birmingham could have been in the running for the playoffs, couldn't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think Birmingham weren't sort of ever a hugely talented side under Rowett. I think he just... you know, made them very difficult to beat. And that was proven effective for sort of the status quo, really. But now it just shows, you know, when you try and change teams too much in the Championship, you can easily just drop right down. And, yeah, thanks, Zola.
Maybe that, going back to maybe that is Pep Guardiola's thinking. Don't want to change it too much. City could have dropped all the way down.
Yeah,
keep what you know at the back. Yeah. So from the Championship to Germany, where there's another big match this week in the midweek fixtures as Dortmund take on Bayern Munich in the semi-finals of the DFB Pokal Cup on Wednesday. Borussia Mönchengladbach and Eintracht Frankfurt play on Tuesday. Frankfurt have been competitive this season. Gladbach have had a bit of a troubled year. But this is probably looking like it's going to produce the decider between Dortmund and Bayern, Greg. It's also been quite a troubled year for Thomas Tuchel's side. We talked earlier about patience with managers. He's got a very young team as well. Do you think the casual observers haven't really been giving him, you know, the due that he needs for what he's been doing this season, aside that this, let's not forget, lost Mats Hummels and Henrik Mkhitaryan in the summer, two really key players?
Yeah, definitely, and replace them, as you say, with young players who often will take time to bed in, move in countries, a lot of them, not just teams. So, yeah, I think maybe the fact that Leipzig have kind of come from nowhere and usurped them in the league, that's maybe increased the pressure on them. Hoffenheim as well are right close with them at the moment. I think they're below them now in the table, but it's all very close, so... Maybe if they'd have got a bit closer to Dortmund, finished second, to Bayern, sorry, finished second, and they would get more credit. But yeah, I think so. And the Champions League as well, the events off the pitch overshadowed their quarterfinal. But if it had gone differently a couple of moments in that, maybe they would have got through as well. So I think they have had a good season. And the young players there, they will improve next year. They will improve in the years to come. And I think that's probably what Dortmund's model has to be, because they're... Once they get these really big world-class stars, they are going to lose them. It looks like the economic reality to other clubs. So I think they need to keep investing in these young players, trying to find the next ones. And I think that hopefully will bring them success at some point.
Bayern drew at the weekend 2-2 with Mainz. Dortmund actually beat the other semi-finalists, Borussia Mönchengladbach, whose opponents Eintracht Frankfurt won 3-1 against Augsburg. Quite a tricky team to beat there as well. But going back to Bayern, they're one of the older sides in Europe now, with Ancelotti a manager who specialises in getting the most out of veteran players to win the big competitions. They might feel a bit unlucky they were knocked out of the Champions League given what happened in their tie against Real Madrid. But does he have a bit of a rebuilding job on his hands this summer now? I mean, we're talking about Hoffenheim, they've got Niklas Süle coming in, they've got Rudi as well there, their defensive midfielder coming in from Hoffenheim. They've snapped up to come in the summer once their contracts are over. Any parallels with his time in Madrid in the way that he poached Ilarramendi and some players like that from other teams?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think, I'm not sure it's a full rebuilding job. I think it's more a kind of a natural progression. And I think, obviously, you're still going to have, you know, plenty of players in there that will continue for a good couple of years.
Robin and Ribery just aren't going to stop.
Yeah, I mean, just because they're aging doesn't necessarily mean they'll retire.
They're going to have two Stanley Matthews on the wings. Yeah. 55-year-old title winners.
But, I mean, yeah, certainly, you know, Lahm, Xabi Alonso, you know, huge players, really. And I think it could be Dortmund again that get raided by Bayern, you know. We've seen them do it before. But I certainly think the Bundesliga is perhaps going to be a bit more interesting over the next couple of years. You know, tide sort of changing a little bit. This great sort of Bayern team that, you know, looks like world dominators, really, for a long time. And now sort of, you know, coming to the end and could see a bit of a change of the tide.
It's not just Bayern Munich that are poaching talent from their rivals in the Bundesliga, of course. Dortmund have actually signed up Mo Dahoud from Borussia Mönchengladbach to come in this summer. And also Toprak, the centre-back from Bayer Leverkusen, is going to be coming in. So you know, it's a bit of a narrative that Bayern are the bad guys, but everyone's getting on with it a bit. And obviously, Red Bull Leipzig haven't been afraid of splashing the cash on some promising young Bundesliga players from other teams as well. But in this match specifically, and perhaps looking forward to the final as well, who are your favourites to win it and why? Dortmund or Bayern? Or maybe one of the other semi-finalists for the win overall, James?
I think Bayern, mainly because of the fact that they got knocked out of the Champions League and they will be desperate to win another trophy. I think, you know, they've got title winners, cup winners in their side. And I think, you know, whereas Dortmund are a much younger side, perhaps less experienced, I think this is the sort of game Bayern will close out and win.
Mm. Do you agree with that, Greg?
Yeah, they played each other in the Bundesliga recently and it very much went that way, where Dortmund had a few flashes, a few moments, but Bayern's experience ultimately kind of...
They looked like a bit of a machine, didn't they?
They did, yeah. They were so dominant in that game for most of it. There was a moment, I think, where Aubameyang missed a chance where it maybe could have turned, but those were few and far between, really, for Dortmund. And it's interesting that these clubs like Bayern now, Juventus probably experience a similar thing in Italy, where if you get knocked out of the Champions League, which Juve haven't done this year, obviously, but even if you're way clear at the top of the league, you kind of still need something else, because that's just a given now for Bayern to win the league so comfortably. So if they were to get knocked out in the semi-final as well, then it's suddenly gone from a potential kind of treble to maybe a disappointing season, perversely, but that's the way it is.
That's the way it goes. And that's all we've got time for today on the Squawker Talker podcast. James, thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Anything you want to be plugging to our listeners this week?
Just keep right on.
how do we follow you on Twitter?
You can catch me on James_Dale_. And I will be tweeting plenty of news and stories about Birmingham City and all that's going on with Harry Redknapp.
Well, look forward to that. Greg Lee, what are you doing this week?
I'm going to Stamford Bridge tonight, Tuesday night. Sellers Park tomorrow for Palace Tottenham. So busy midweek round of Premier League action and I'll be all across it.
And where can we find you on Twitter?
At Greg Lee Football.
Wonderful. Do get following them on Twitter and do join us again later this week on Friday when I'll be back with another episode of the Squawker Talker podcast. Nick English will be back the week after, so do tune in for him. Thanks for joining us and see you again soon.